We are fortunate to have with us Father Malachi Martin, and we are going to be discussing about the situation in the church today. And Father, you can start off by telling us just a little bit about yourself and what you're doing now and what some of your background is.
Yes, Bernard, of course. I was born in Ireland 68 years ago. I joined the Jesuits, and eventually, after the usual training of 17 years, passing through various European countries and universities, I ended up in Rome as a professor at the Pontifical Biblical Institute. I was trained as a paleographer. Most of our listeners don't know what that is. It's somebody who studies handwriting, and my expertise was in Middle Eastern handwriting about the time of Abraham. But that became a very useful profession for the then Pope John the 23rd, because he needed contacts with both Arabs and Jews, and I traveled extensively in that area, the Middle East, and therefore I was useful to him. And I got very closely associated with John the 23rd and a certain cardinal called Cardinal Augustine Beer. He was the man who was in charge of ecumenism and who traveled extensively in the States during the Council. But before that time, I had asked my superior for permission to leave the Jesuits, and in 1964, Paul VI, who was then Pope, granted me the permission. He gave me permission to leave the Society of Jesus, and he secularized me. That is, I didn't want to be laicized. I wanted to be secularized. That is, I didn't want to be under a bishop incarnated in a diocese. I didn't want to belong to a religious order. I didn't want to join Opus Dei. The only three alternatives for a clergyman, for a priest, in the Catholic Church. So he granted me that and gave me a general commission to write and to be active in the field of communications about the Church. And then I went from there to the United States, passing through Paris, and I arrived here just 25 years ago, in January 1965. And from then on, I've been writing books and been very engaged in radio and television. I think I'm known probably as a conservative. We love tags in the United States. Some people would call me a traditionalist. But, Bernard, I'm a Catholic. I'm a Catholic priest. And I say my Mass every morning. And when permitted by the local bishop, I engage in the usual priestly activities. But my main activity is writing and confessional work and pastoral care of people who, today, in the condition of the Church, don't find pastoral care available, especially families who are at sixes and sevens about what is happening to them and their children and the public weal. That's a brief history. My books sell well. I've had three or four bestsellers. And that's due to the grace of God and not to anything I've written.
Could you please tell us a bit about a few of the books you've written that have sold fairly well? The most commonly spoken about one is The Jesuits.
That's right. It was, because it was the first book published which, in cameo, outlined what had happened, the major orders of the Church. In brief, between 1965 and 1975, the major orders in the Church, Jesuits, Dominicans, Franciscans, Carmelites, literally turned their backs on the papacy and proceeded to follow a line about the Church and about the mission of salvation of the Church, which is at variance with the traditional Catholic view of life and death and resurrection. I did merely a cameo study of the Jesuits, and immediately it was applied to all the other orders. They began to realize that something was extremely rotten in the state of Denmark, that if the Jesuits could have gone like that, and they did go like that, then they could explain the vagaries of the Franciscans and the horrible corruption of the Dominican order. And all these orders had been the bastions of the Church for centuries. And, you know, it's a terrible reflection I have, Bernard, that today, what John Paul II needs at the present moment, like he needs air to breathe, he needs a body of men, highly trained, specialists all, in every possible department and sector of human life. He needs them internationally established, at all the choke points of civilization, Africa, Asia, America, North and South, Canada, the Soviet Union, old Europe, Western Europe and Central Europe and Scandinavia. He needs them highly centralized. He needs them utterly obedient to the voice of Peter. He needs them utterly devoted to Our Lady and her Lord. He needs them as priests. And that was the Jesuits. That's exactly what Ignatius had in mind. And today, they are not there any longer. Physically, in the sense that they're going down in numbers. You know, there are less than 1,000 Jesuits in the United States today. I think in 1965 there were 8,500. And every third man in the missions was a Jesuit. But it's not merely numerically. It is the quality. They literally have declared a silent war on the papacy.
Which is an exact reversal of their fourth vow, which is loyalty to the papacy.
Obedience. Blind obedience was the keynote. And that is why they were so valuable to the Pope, even to the point of permitting him to kill them off in the 18th century for the good of the Church, and then to revive them about 70 years later because he found he needed them. But that was perfect obedience. That's gone. So the Jesuits did create a stir and earned a lot of hatred for me and misunderstanding, except from the older Jesuits and from some of the younger Jesuits who realized that the truth was being told. Now, that was a very good-selling book in the sense that it did a lot of good. It did an awful lot of good. It did open up what we call in the States a can of worms. It did show what happened. And the fact was, I had Jesuits writing me privately, anonymously, with money to cover 50 copies to be sent to an anonymous address, a P.O.B. box somewhere, because they didn't dare show the book in public. The other book which created a lot of stir was a book called Hostage to the Devil, published in 1975, and it's the only published record of five exorcisms of living Americans. It was based on video and audio tapes, because I have been a very active in exorcism all my life. It was a bestseller here and abroad, and it still is. What it does is this. It proved that any man or woman over 50 who doesn't realize that out in those streets and in those boardrooms and in the boudoirs and in the corporate headquarters and in the army headquarters and the government chanceries, who doesn't realize that Satan is alive and active and happy, that man or woman is a jackass.
That is a very difficult concept for the modern mind to grasp, because one of the first teachings of the Church that is being sort of pushed aside by modern theologians has been a belief in Satan, the devil, and hell.
That's right. It's the best PR job ever done. He doesn't exist. He doesn't exist. But please do this. Please kill the babies before they're born. Please establish a third way of life. It's human rights. The homosexuals have the same rights as heterosexuals. Please make homosexual marriage all right. Please use these contraceptives, because then you'll benefit all mankind. We'll limit the population. It doesn't really matter if the people in East Timor are being killed off by the Indonesians. It doesn't hurt us. He's everywhere. He is everywhere, producing this demand for reason and tolerance and non-fanatic outlook. And every man is his own law, and every conscience is its own guide. This is the best PR going. But the devil, the old figure with horns and a dirty tail and yellow eyes and dirty books under his arm, hiding behind the bushes and saying, come over and I'll show you some sin. Oh no, that's myth and superstition. It always was. This is an angelic intelligence, far more potent than any human intelligence could ever be. It's an angelic intelligence, and it is engaged in a life-to-death battle with one man, who's God, Jesus.
We've got ourselves into a state of affairs, I think, both in the world and the Church, where the devil is active and well. And we'll be discussing this situation later on. But to understand how we got there, we have to go back in time to the days of before the Second Vatican Council, when at least everything appeared to be all right in the Church. Among conservative people, there is some debate about, is that period in the Church of the 1950s, let's say, before the Second Vatican Council, was it a very positive period, or was it a negative period, or what is a bit of both? What are, let's say, some of your reflections on that period of history, just shortly before the Second Vatican Council?
Well, we can take this, Bernard, we can take this from a purely what they call historical point of view today, which is a secularist point of view. And you can say, well, there was this teacher who was a bit wonky in his theology, and there was this movement in the 30s about the liturgy which the Pope had to suppress. But, you know, if you'd allow me, I think we should get an overview of this, first of all.
Well, why don't we do that?
The overview was given by the one person, apart from Jesus Christ, who could give it to us, and that was the Blessed Virgin Mary. She did appear 6 times in 1917. And the last time was October 13, 1917, to 3 children and to 75,000 people. There was a miracle, the miracle of Fatima, at noontime at Fatima in Portugal. Fatima is a small little hamlet 75 miles from Lisbon, the capital of Portugal. Let's not delay for the moment. We can go back to it later on, the miracle of the sun, because it's the paramount miracle of the 20th century, perhaps the 5 centuries. But she did convey 3 secrets to those children and told them not to publish them yet, but to convey them to the local bishop. And one of those secrets has become the famous third secret. Now, that third secret was conveyed or written on one sheet of paper to the Pope, finally, in the 1950s, about 1954 to 1957. The dates are always discussed by people. We know now the general lines of that secret. In effect, we know details. But the one outstanding thing was, Our Lady said that the Pope of 1960 had to open the envelope and read this secret and then do what she said. And the secret, apparently, on the authority of the Pope, on the authority of Cardinal Ratzinger, on the authority of many people, said the following. It was an either-or. It was an ultimatum. The world is gone so far, by this time, the secret said, that unless Russia is converted by being consecrated to my Immaculate Heart, then faith will disappear from nations and continents. Cardinals and bishops and priests will fall like leaves into hell. In other words, it was an either or. But if the Pope, in union with the bishops of the Church, in 1960, consecrates Russia, just Russia, the Soviet Union, the USSR, to my Immaculate Heart, then Russia will be converted and faith will be restored. Well, the sad aftermath of this is this, that Pope John XXIII, whom I knew, did open the secret. And he opened it privately, first of all, in Castel Gandolfo in August 1959. And then in 1960, he opened it in the presence of several cardinals. Cardinal Bea was there, my cardinal, and with 2 Portuguese interpreters. And reading it, and finding out that he was supposed to publicly, in union with all the bishops, and they were gathering into Rome, by the way, 2 years later, he was supposed to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary and declare it to be a source of evil, but would be converted. He decided that Nikita Khrushchev, who was the strong man in Russia at that time, would take this as an act of war. Now, do you know, you may not know, that under Nikita Khrushchev, between 1958 and 1963, the most virulent anti-religious persecution took place in the Soviet Union.
It's interesting. I do have family in Russia.
Uh-huh.
And what a lot of people don't know is that the persecution under Khrushchev was even more severe than that of Stalin.
Much more severe. Much more severe. Well, so John said, I can't do that. I can't, because Nikita Khrushchev then would stop talking to me. At that time, he was talking to John because John had one dream. He wanted observers from the Russian Orthodox Church to be present at his council. So at that meeting of cardinals, he took a sheet of paper and wrote on it, questo, meaning the letter, non è per nostri tempi, is not for our times. Put it back in the box of the letter and closed it. He refused the mandate of Our Lady for his own good geopolitical reasons. I think it was short-sighted. And above all, I think he disobeyed Our Lady. But I'm a simple priest. I'm not Pope. That's my judgment. When Paul VI came in, he read the letter and decided to do nothing about it. John Paul I read the letter, but he had only 34 days to live. John Paul II read the letter at the beginning of his pontificate in 78, October 78, and put it aside. And he only took it up again in 1981 when he lay in Gemelli Hospital, wounded. And then he suddenly realized that indeed Our Lady had saved him on May 13 from the bullets of Mehmet Ali Agca, the assassin. And he sent again for the letter and all the documents and Lucia, Sister Lucia's writings. She's the only surviving child. And then he sent a message over to the Bishop of Leiria and to Lucia asking their advice about one point. And then in 1984, he consecrated the entire world.
Which is not what Our Lady asked for.
Nope. He made a special mention of Russia, saying the peoples, meaning the Russians, who still await their special consecration. In other words, the consecration hasn't been done. The point I'm making to you, Bernard, is that Our Lady's either or is in action. She said, unless this is done, unless it's made public to all nations and all governments, all peoples, then faith will disappear from nations and continents. There will be huge catastrophes. Many people will die. But in the end, my Immaculate Heart will save people. So if you want an overview of what's happened, take it like this. How come, or take an image, I think it was in 1966, suddenly all electric power disappeared from the northeast corner of the United States. The reservoir, filled with juice, as we say in the United States, suddenly was emptied. Nobody has as yet explained how it all disappeared like that. Similarly, if you look at the church between 1965 and 1975, suddenly Catholicity disappeared. Suddenly. Priests left, nuns left, suddenly bizarre ceremonies took place, suddenly every practice like devotion to the Sacred Heart, to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, confraternities, sodalities, St. Vincent de Paul work, pilgrimages, benedictions of the Blessed Sacrament, the habit of visiting the Blessed Sacrament, children's first Holy Communion, marriage, abortion, contraception, homosexuality, everything was turned upside down. Suddenly, the reservoir of Catholicism suddenly was sucked out, disappeared. And the only theological way you can look at that, theology, not historical, in the secular sense, is that God withdrew grace. God withdrew grace, sanctifying grace, without which you can't be Catholic. That's the overall view of what happened. And that's why Pope John Paul II in Fulda in 1980, when confronted with very fervent German Catholics, they said, Holy Father, why don't you renew the church? He said, I can't. Renewal is impossible until Our Lady comes. He was quoting the echo of that letter. And then he put his hands in his pocket and pulled out his rosary and said, that's your only weapon, the rosary. Pray, pray, and do nothing else but pray. So his mind from the very beginning was made up. I cannot renew my church. It can't be renewed because renewal is only possible through grace. You can't do it by organization. You can't do it by any human means. That is his attitude, and that's the explanation of it. Now, on the other hand, if you descend into details, you will find that, for instance, the big, big surrender on the part of the church. By the way, Bernard, when I say the church, I'm always talking about churchmen. There are two things to be distinguished. The church essentially is the mystical body of Jesus. What is that? The words that people toss out, what does it mean? It means this. That there is a body, there is a group of people on earth and in heaven who are in the state of grace. And being in the state of grace, that is the church without spot or wrinkle. That belongs to Jesus completely. There is a body of people in purgatory who are being purged and cleansed by grace. And they also belong to the mystical body. That's the church suffering, the church militant, and the church triumphant. That's the church, essentially. It has a visible organization, an institutional organization called Roman Catholicism, based in Rome, the first bishop of Rome, the Pope, and then consisting of dioceses run by bishops, all of whom are supposed to be subject to the Pope, to obey the Petrine authority of the keys of St. Peter.
And we will be using the term church in line with the institutional church.
That's right. Whenever we speak about the church, we're talking about the institutional organization, not that pure and holy body of people. Nowadays, of course, the numbers who really belong there, that's another question. Nobody can say. But we can go back to that question at another moment in this talk. Now, the church itself, if you examine its progress, say, since 1930s, you'll find that the seedbed of all the errors that have plagued the church and do plague the church today, began then. They began then. Now, the biggest plague, the biggest triumph of Satan is the destruction of the Mass. Because without the Mass, without valid priests saying valid Masses, being ordained validly by validly ordained consecrated bishops, we have no Mass. We have no Blessed Sacrament. The presence of Jesus is wiped out.
Let's go back here now to the reign of Pius XII.
Yes.
He put out an encyclical called Mediator Dei.
1946.
Yes. So this liturgical movement must have been active long before Novus Ordo Mass was introduced.
In the 1930s, it was. And in that Mediator Dei, as you've known, but let's remind our listeners, he actually says, and there are some people who want to take away the tabernacle from the altar. He listed all the
they want to take away black vestments.
That's right. That's right. They want the place to face the people. But why did he do that? Because in Belgium and France and Germany of the 30s, there was a movement, a liturgical movement, mainly started by Benedictines, but also supported by the Jesuits, which proposed all these things, proposed people masses. And when it came to the Vatican Council itself, as you know, the last vote in the Council in 1965 concerned the Mass. And the bishops were absolutely categorical. They said, do not wipe out the Latin. Keep the Latin Mass, but translate the popular parts, meaning the Credo, the Gloria, the prayer before Mass, the prayers, the intraebo Mass, prayers as we call them, and the communion prayers at the end. Put those in the popular language. But the canon stands. This was the Council. And I remember that a bishop who had visited Paul VI just after the end of the Council in December 1965 came in to me here in New York and said, you know, Malachy, the most extraordinary thing happened to me. I was speaking with the Pope, His Holiness, 2 days ago, and I congratulated him on the vote in the Council. And he said, don't speak to me about the vote. Don't congratulate me. There are already 18 new canons in vogue in France. They've gone haywire. They've already translated into vernacular, and the thing is not valid anymore, and I have no control over it. So what happened? Well, there was a character called Bugnini, Annibale Bugnini, who was a Freemason, member of the Lodge, who set as his goal to create a new ceremony in the Catholic Church. He has this in his articles published in the Italian Revista, which could be accepted by anybody, Catholic or non-Catholic or non-Christian.
So it's an ecumenical religion. And because Bugnini was a Freemason, one wonders if he was doing this in the long run to lead towards the creation of a one-world religion.
Of course he was. Of course he was. The difficulty is that he wasn't alone. He had powerful friends. And by the way, just as a footnote, you know that the official canon of the Mass now, the new Mass, the Novus Ordo, was composed by 6 Protestant clergymen and 2 Catholic clergymen. How bastardized can you become? No matter how pious and good these men were, they're not Catholics. They didn't know the Catholic tradition. But anyway, let's go on. What we have to acknowledge, too, is that there was a very carefully laid out integrated plan to make sure that no statement of the Vatican Council, if possible, couldn't be ambivalent. And I remember Cardinal Bea coming to see me once in my room in Rome, and this was 1962, sweating. And the Council had just begun. It was November 1962. And I asked him why he was disturbed. And he said, because I just heard an awful remark by Hans Kuhn. He was talking to, and he named an American theologian, who is now a bishop, who shall remain unnamed. And he said, Kung, in answer to a question by this man, I didn't hear the question, said, oh, no, this time we're not going to leave. We're not going to have another reformation. We're staying inside this time. Which gives an eye-opener on what the plan was. And the plan was simply to make sure that the traditional Romanist Catholic traits of the Church would be wiped out. The result is that if you examine all the documents of the Vatican Council, there are 15 main ones, you'll find that except for something like the Mass, what it says about the Mass, the old Mass, the Roman Mass, as I always call it, I refuse the name Tridentine even, because Trent did not invent this Mass. It was the old Roman Mass celebrated by Pope Damasus in the 5th century. The idea was to make sure that this, no statement of the Council would stand that could not be interpreted ambivalently. For instance, nuns must modernize their dress. It's quite clear from the discussions in the Council at that time, they meant, well, get rid of things which are really a hindrance, say, in a subway, or a hindrance simply are out of place. They certainly didn't mean nuns to walk around with pearl necklaces and lipstick and powder and hot pants and hot dresses and to sit in cocktails in large hotels having their annual conventions. They meant nuns to have a garb, a religious garb, a sign of their devotion to the spouse they had married by their vows.
What seems to have happened is a complete revolution, because for a nun to go from heavily garbed into lipstick and watching television and miniskirts, it's a total turnaround.
It was destruction. It was destruction. Not only that, but there were a whole, as you know, in California, it was a whole set of schools that simply, all the nuns simply left the order, left the church. But that was carefully done in the Vatican Council. Everything was left ambivalently. And the main thing was left ambivalent was religious liberty and the idea of communism. As you know, 500 fathers asked Paul VI to allow them to condemn communism. They were forbidden. That was one of the agreements that John 23rd made with Nikita Khrushchev. That was one of the things that haunts us today.
Let's talk about this Rome-Moscow agreement. What is this Rome-Moscow agreement?
Well, the Rome-Moscow agreement is very simple. John 23rd did feel that if he could get two Russian observers in Rome for the council, that it would be Pentecostal. Nikita Khrushchev knew well the power of propaganda and the voice of the church. And already the satellite countries were in trouble, and Russia was in trouble too. So he said, provided there's no condemnation of Marxism by the church or of the USSR, and he had several other things besides that, but that was the main thing, then I will grant permission for two observers. The negotiations were carried on by Cardinal Tisserand, French cardinal, in the house of the Bishop of de Smet. He was a French bishop in Metz, in the city of Metz. And they were concluded satisfactorily, and the two observers arrived. The Rome-Moscow agreement, therefore, meant that there was an unofficial line between the Vatican and the Kremlin from then on. That had been established, by the way, during the war by a man called Monsignore Giovanni Battista Montini, behind Pastor 12th back. And Pastor 12th was utterly enraged when he found it. It was one of the reasons why finally he expelled Montini and made him Archbishop of Milano. And then for later on, after his death, he became, as you know, Paul VI. And another man who was very active at that time in the Vatican State Department was Agostino Casaroli.
We know a lot about him.
Yes. He's the Secretary of State. And he gathered around him an entire band of people who are very anti-American, very anti-Anglo-Saxon. And it's not that they want to become communists. They just believe that the pie can be carved up differently. And they never got very far until John Paul II came in with his personal charisma and made it possible for us to have this interview with Gorbachev. But that's a completely different question, what is happening now under John Paul II. The trend in the Vatican was to allow the Marxist idea to pervade Christianity, which emerged, as you know, in liberation theology in Latin America. It was never suppressed, even though John Paul II has made more than three trips to Latin America to suppress it. And that was the Rome-Moscow Pact. And it's still in vogue. It's still in vogue. And Rome has not gone back on it. Vatican diplomacy is such that once a mistake has been made, it generally tries to live with it. It rarely tries to obliterate the mistake. Rarely does. So it has lived with this all during the reign of Paul VI. And there were contacts. All the bully boys of the satellite nations went to see Paul VI in the 70s. And President Podgorny, Nikolai Podgorny, way back in 1967, I think, came to the Vatican to see him. And Paul VI used to receive this famous man, Metropolitan Nicodem, who was the go-between. He was the Metropolitan Bishop of Leningrad and Ladoga, second highest ranking bishop in the Soviet Union. It was he who negotiated with Tisserand this Moscow Pact, and it was he who died in the arms of John Paul I, as you know.
Do you think that the Russian Orthodox Church, led by Nicodem, is very much a puppet church?
Absolutely a puppet church. It's as one Russian said to me, it is deviled. I can't translate the Russian word in any other way. He said, we have been servants of the devil for so long, we have forgotten what we are. And if you want to measure, Bernard, the amount of devilment in the Russian Orthodox Church as an organization, think of the following fact. that nobody can be of any prominence in the Russian Orthodox Church unless he's a member of the KGB. Nikodym himself was a colonel in the KGB. He was tortured 11 times by the KGB. They thought he was turning tail on them, which he finally did.
What do Catholics behind the Iron Curtain think about the Rome-Moscow agreement?
First of all, let's be clear on the condition of Catholics behind the Iron Curtain. Contrary to what a lot of people would like to think, the condition of youth and the condition of the Church behind the Iron Curtain is almost worse than the condition of the Church in the United States and Europe. Almost worse. But there are solid bodies of believers who have clung on, mainly in the Ukraine, by the way, where you have 4 to 5 million Ukrainians who literally have been having Mass in forest glades and behind rocks, much as the Irish had for 400 years during the British occupation of Ireland. Now, they have regarded all contact with the Soviet Union as abhorrent, because they lived with the commissars. They felt the whips. They were sent to the gulag. They lost their priests and bishops and nuns and churches and convents. They regarded it as blasphemy. They could not understand it. And they don't understand it. Because they have lived with the demon called Marxism under Stalin and Nikita Khrushchev and under Mr. Gorbachev and under all the intermediary figures. They know the truth about everything. They have no illusions whatever. And if you talk with people like Cardinal Tomaszek of Prague, who's now free to say his Mass over the television, you'll find that his eyes film over when you question him about the goodness and the wisdom of the Rome-Moscow Pact. They regard themselves as having been delivered lock, stock and barrel into the hands of the Soviets. Because they say, if at any given moment Rome had flung its full weight publicly, against the Soviet Union, as Pastor tried to, but at that stage he was almost 80 and physically too weak and psychologically broken down. And already the tentacles were spreading into the Vatican, the tentacles of what they call the superforce, which is now within the Vatican bureaucracy itself. If the Church had done that, if the prestige it had coming out after the Second World War, the prestige was huge in America and in Canada and in Latin America, no doubt about it, it could have curbed what Stalin was doing. It could have curbed Nikita Khrushchev. It could have made a difference. We didn't do it. We compromised. One small example, I'll tell you. Paul VI assembled, got all the bishops of Vietnam assembled in Saigon and sent over a special emissary, a cardinal, whose name begins Pinedoli, to tell them to advocate surrender and peace with North Vietnam. Total surrender. Why did he do that? He did that because he had been influenced by Metropolitan Nikodym, who brought a message from the North Vietnamese through Moscow that the North Vietnamese wanted peace and they needed 6 months to prepare themselves. This was in 1968. In 1968, the United States had leveled North Vietnam. They had no hope of winning. So Lyndon Johnson was faced with the request from Paul VI that he not bomb anymore, that he not do any more war destruction. He wait until spring. And what happened in spring, or February, the Tet Offensive. They had rearmed, and they came back like a lion. And from then on, it was downhill for the United States. But in the meantime, Paul VI got his bishops to vote for peace, against any furtherance of war, any resistance. And that is called compromise. And compromise was the message. Compromise, sacrifice, wait. Which is not the action of a militant church conscious of its own strength. It was compromise. And the result was that Minzenti, for instance, was hauled out of the legation in Budapest, where he had been for 15 years, promised that nobody would be made cardinal in his lifetime, put in a seminary in Vienna, and immediately appointed a new man, Likoy, who was a Marxist. He's dead now, the cardinal. But he was an open Marxist. There was compromise all over the place. That was the result of the Moscow Pact. And the result was that when the Latin Americans in the late 70s started with their liberation theology, everybody said, well, the church has a pacific approach to all this, and obviously you can Christianize Marxism. Well, what happened was they Marxized Christianity, because liberation theology is merely Marxism with a Christian face. Christ becomes the revolutionary. Mary is the mother of all the revolutionaries. The bread of life is no longer in the tabernacle. The bread of life is not what we manufacture in our factory, which no longer belongs to the...
It's a materialistic ideology,
yeah,
then.
But in Christian terminology. That's the point.
Ah, so it's Marxism with a Christian veneer, then.
That's right. If you attended any of the meeting of the base communities, Comunidades de Base in Latin America, of which there are 600,000 now, they trample on the cross. They say this castrates the people. Jesus was a revolutionary. He was killed because he was against the witch. And they use all the words about Jesus leading them. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Take up the cross of war. This is Marxism.
They have turned the truth upside down, because one of Christ's basic messages was that his message and his kingdom was not of this world.
Of course, of course. But they have made it now. And that's why Paul VI made the error too, in his own way, misguidedly, declaring that now we will work with man for a better world. But this is not the mission of the church. And that's where John Paul II has never erred. He knows exactly what salvation means. Now, it is very clever of Marxism, because, as you know, what it did in Latin America is it penetrated Christian culture. And that is why, say, Nicaragua had the support of the Jesuits and Carmelites and Dominicans and Franciscans. And in Latin Central America, it is rare to find a priest who is not Marxized in his priesthood, in his so-called pastoral care. And while the Jesuits in Managua ran a school for Marxist tactics.
Let's take a look, though, at the situation here in the United States and in my country in Canada. The bishops put out these statements from time to time on defense and economics. Are Marxists behind those statements? Because there seems to be a lot of left-wing terminology in these.
Marxization is. They have been Marxized. The essence of Marxism is this. But let's get quite clear between us. The essence of Marxism is this. Don't look beyond the human horizon. You, man, are capable of infinite perfectibility, providing that you get the capitalist jackals off your back. The people, they are the source of power. They are the source of perfection and of happiness. Don't look to anything transcendent. Everything is immanent to you. All your powers are there, but you've just been hindered by the rich and the oppressive capitalist lackeys. That's the essence of Marxism. The rest of it, the workers' paradise, the proletarian revolution, those are all historical accretions which can be changed, as Gorbachev has, to other phraseology, to reasonableness and tolerance and lack of fanaticism. But the essence is, I want you to look at this world only. Don't expect salvation from on high. There's no message from beyond the stars. There's no salvation out there. Jesus is a man. We are men. That's the essence of Marxism. Now, the bishops in this country and in your country and in Europe, concentrating exclusively on sociological and political and military questions like nuclear disarmament and on the environment and on AIDS and condoms, let me use that awful word, of which nobody knows the origin, and everything else, are purely and simply acting as social engineers. There is no pastoral care. There is, for instance, I read with horror the pastoral letter of Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles on the Blessed Eucharist. I assure you, it could be read by the Dalai Lama and accepted. It is totally and simply a sociological document. And apart from other blotches on Cardinal Mahoney's behavior, like absolving people from any obligation to go to Mass on Monday after Christmas Day, because they won't go anyway, he said. Some of us felt like writing to him saying, listen, we want to commit adultery tomorrow. Would you please absolve us, because we're going to do it anyway? This is not Catholicity. This is an imminent, this world attitude to make do with the social conditions that there are. Women want to be priests? Why not? They have their rights. I want to be a homosexual? Why not? It's your right. It's another lifestyle, because it's all immanent. You can make it happen. This is the essence of Marxism. We have been penetrated.
Could it be, then, that the common thread of what has happened since the Second Vatican Council is that the Church has been secularized, that humanism has replaced Catholicity?
It has. It has. But the key to that is just one person, one intelligence, Satan, Lucifer. He has successfully sold a bill of goods to the majority of Catholic bishops. Namely, that their job now is to align the Catholic people with the movement of peoples towards human perfection in a very interdependent society of nations. That is what they've been sold. And they will not do anything that violates that. And that's why you can safely describe our bench of bishops in this country, there are about 300 of them, as the religious arm of the left wing of the Democratic Party. It toes the line, right down the line.
And it seems that they're spineless. Like on the issue of abortion and various other liberalizations that have occurred since the 1960s on divorce or what have you, they have been totally spineless in opposing those movements.
Totally. And the compromises they made were terribly embarrassing. Now, because, for instance, when Governor Cuomo of this state, New York, came out in favor of abortion funding, and he procures abortions by financing them, there was no condemnation. He's a public figure. Now, from the very beginning, you should have made it clear. Anybody who votes for abortion fundings procures abortions, in other words, just as sure as the surgeon procures the abortion, or the wife who submits to abortion, or the husband who pays for it. Anybody who does is excommunicated, can't receive the sacrament. He can go to Mass, or he or she can go to Mass, but until they confess it and repent in public, they can't receive the sacraments. That should have been applied holus bolus in the very beginning. It wasn't. So when Bishop Marr of San Diego excommunicated or declared that the candidate for election, I forget her name, Killer or something like that in California, on account of her abortion behavior, or favoring of abortion, could not receive the sacraments, everybody howled at him. How dare you interfere with the political rights? From the very beginning, they should have made it clear, this is not a question of political rights, this is religion, this is our stance. They didn't. They didn't. You know one main failure there? This is the theme we should, I think, hit upon, Gordon, is this. When Jesus left us, visibly, he didn't give us armies, didn't promise empires. He promised we'd be hated, by the way. He promised the world would always be against us. But he said, you have one thing, you have a spiritual weapon, my grace. The one thing the bishops have not used is their spiritual weapon, the grace at their disposal. Let me give you an example. Recently here, in the last 4 weeks, St. Patrick's Cathedral was desecrated by the homosexual organizations. They invaded it, they interrupted the Mass, they broke the host into pieces and threw it on the ground. They were insulting, and they had placards which were blasphemous. Cardinal John O'Connor purified the church canonically. But he never once decided to use the spiritual weapon of consecration to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. What he should have done, what many advised, was that he consecrate the homosexual community of New York to Our Lady's Immaculate Heart, asking for grace they be converted. Because the only power we have is that grace. They haven't used that grace. They have not used that grace. They have not used the spiritual weapon. And therefore the spiritual weapon is lying dormant. And we are at sixes and sevens, we don't know what to think. We're just hurt, and we want to be Americans, and we want to be like everybody else, and we want to be at peace with everybody.
Catholics have joined the world, in other words.
That's right, that's right. That's the bill of goods that's sold. You've got to be part of this. Otherwise, why be fanatic? You're not American, you're not Canadian, you're not good citizens. You've got to be part of it. That's the bill of goods that's been sold by one archangelic intelligence. Now, when Lucia was speaking with Our Lady in one of her visions, there was a very poignant moment when Our Lady said to her, look, my child, don't be surprised if at a certain moment a certain diabolical disorientation affects the best of minds, a disequilibrium so that they no longer judge according to the voice of my son and of Peter. And you know, when you regard the way the bishops have acted and the way priests act and the way theologians act and the way the best sometimes make awful errors talking out of two sides of their mouth, you realize that there is a disorientation. They no longer know what it is to be Catholic. They no longer know. They no longer have the Catholic instinct. And why it's safe to say that we no longer have a Catholic people. What we have is this, we have one-on-one groups who still hold, who are still Catholic. And amongst my associates in the United States and abroad, the first question we ask about anybody who looms up on the horizon for the first time with an appointment or a book or whatever, we say, is he Catholic? And we don't mean has he been baptized. We mean, is he still of the faith? Does he believe? Does he practice what he believes? Does he live it out? Does he say the rosary? Does he go to Mass? Does he go to confession? Does he uphold the Petrine authority? Because that is the crux, Petrine authority. That is the aim of the entire revolt of the bishops, to get rid of the Petrine authority. And it's almost got rid of in practice, as you know.
It looks like that there's really only pockets of Catholicism left throughout the world.
Just pockets, just pockets. And anybody who doesn't realize that by now has his head stuck on the sand. Because the church has now been blanketed. You see, it's very easy in the church. It's composed of an organization of dioceses and parishes. And the pipeline into that comes from Rome, through the bishops. The bishops have occupied all the choke points of that pipeline, and they have piped into it a new structure, the Novus Ordo, the RCIA, if you people in Canada have experienced the RCIA.
What is that?
That is the new way of Christian initiation. And if you read the manuals, it's baptism in another form, you'll find out that it's full of the most amazing amalgam of naturalism, environmental love, a bit of voodoo, some witchcraft, some Wicca, as we call it in this country, W-I-C-C-A, some Protestant traits, but absent is genuine Catholicism. And then we have, in addition to RCIA, we have a thing called Renew, which is a form of renewal, they call it. And it means chiefly that the idea of a priest offering the Mass is out, that the people now have the power, that they decide what prayers to say, and they decide what their approach to sin is. This has been piped into schools and parishes so that it has blanketed the Catholic Church in the United States and abroad, has changed people without them knowing they've been changed. They've been led by Pied Pipers out of the church. You know, if you went around England in 1530 and said to anybody, "Are you Catholic?" They said, "Of course I'm Catholic." By 1630, several men had worked on them. And if you went around in 1630 and said, "Are you Catholic?" They said, "Of course I am." But at that time, they no longer had Mass. They no longer had any obedience to the Pope. They no longer recited the credo we always recited. They no longer had the virtues. They were into Protestantism, but they did not know it. They were Anglicans. They no longer had valid priests. They no longer had valid sacraments, confession, baptism, holy orders, anointing of the sick. That was all gone, and they didn't know it. Similarly with the Mass of the Catholic people, they don't know. They don't. How could they know?
The institution is still there.
That's right. It's a grand illusion. We have cardinals and bishops and priests and nuns and convents and monasteries and printing presses and Catholic libraries and Catholic colleges and Catholic books. But it's an illusion.
So it's a facade.
It's a facade. Behind which there is nothing that would be even permitted by past popes or past the past churchmen. Wouldn't be permitted. Wouldn't be simply allowed. They'd kick you out on your ear.
Let's go back to Pope Pius XII on this point. Did he foresee that something like this was going to happen?
Yes, that's why he refused to have a general council. He refused anything like that, and why he was insistent on two or three things. No truck with Marxism. No even talking with Marxism. Utter separation and waiting and blocking them. And why he tried to set up an underground church in Russia itself. And he had five bishops and seven apostolic administrators in Stalin's Russia until they were betrayed. A man came down once, said he was a Russian Orthodox, entered a Roman seminary, was trained, was ordained, and went back to Russia. He was a Russian spy with all the names. And overnight, everything disappeared. They were all taken and killed. That liquidated Pastor XII's attempt to have an underground in the Soviet Union. But that was one point he stressed, Marxism. Another point he stressed was Our Lady. He stressed this devotion to Our Lady. It finally became a sort of a joke amongst the bishops who were already losing their faith that you couldn't get near him unless you were saying the rosary. But by that time, the work of the devil had started and devotion was diminishing. Besides that, then, it became very, very voguish in Europe and the United States for the religious orders to send their men to secular universities. The plea was, if they go to secular universities, they will know what the other side are saying, as if you couldn't read it in their books and listen to it in their lectures. The result was they turned out a generation, my generation, of thinkers, theologians, bishops later, cardinals later, who had absorbed secularist ideas, and with all their friends and careers and honorableness linked with a world which is totally anti-Catholic. And that was part of the seeding for Vatican II. Now, That was the first thing that... there were two things that passed the 12th age. The third thing he hit very hard, but always just touching it, because he hadn't read the third secret, was the coming destruction of the church and of civilization. It's a note you find in creeping into his public sermons and addresses and in some of his letters, because he had got communications from Lucia, Sister Lucia, the surviving child of Fatima, and from others about what Our Lady had said was going to happen. But by the time he got to that, his main work was done. His main work was during the war. That was his main work, to resist Nazism, to resist Mussolini, and to tide the church over that period. That was, I think, what Providence called him for. After that, and then he did manage to keep Italy out of communism by organizing the Demo Christiani, the Democratic Party in Italy. By 1950, when he defined the Assumption of Our Lady, which was one of his big acts, he was already in bad health. And from then on, he slid down a very slippery slope of very bad health. And finally, he succumbed in 1958. October, I think it was, 1958. And John was elected, John XXIII was elected.
Let's take a look at John the 23rd. Was he a liberal, or was he simply naive?
He was a liberal. He was a very, very liberal. As you know, John was removed from teaching at the Lateran University because of modernism, way back in the beginning of his career. In fact, he could have ended there. He could have ended up as a parish priest in Bergamo, except he had friends in the propaganda. It was called that time propaganda fide, that is, the propagation of the faith, dissemination of the evangelical message. And they gave him a job, and from then he went on to another job. And then they found he was very useful as a diplomat, because John was very calm and roly-poly, and obviously meant well, and as the French said about him, he was bonne fourchette, he was a good fork, could eat a good hearty meal of pasta, he was great at children's communions, and he was very kind. He did save innumerable thousands of Jews in Hungary during the war by issuing about 27,000 false baptismal certificates which were passed around and saved them. And in Bulgaria, the same thing. As you know, the Jews in Bulgaria, there were more Jews in Bulgaria at the end of the war than there were at the beginning because of the activity of both the king of Bulgaria at that time and the archbishop and Roncalli. And then he was very useful in Paris after the war with de Gaulle, because de Gaulle couldn't dislike this man. And de Gaulle, the Vatican's big problem in France after the war was that many bishops had supported the Vichy, the pro-German faction in France, and they were condemned to death in principle. So John maneuvered the church out of that difficulty. Then he was made Patriarch of Venice as a reward, and nobody expected him to become Pope. But in 1958, he was the only man they could light upon, because the cardinals were in disarray about what to do about the church at that time. Yes, he was a liberal, and in addition to that, he was theologically ignorant, extremely ignorant. He had the garden of the soul variety of devotionalism. If you read his Diary of a Soul, it's very simple, simplistic almost. He was wily, as a peasant is. He came from peasants who had been fighting with the elements and land and animals for hundreds of years. He was monoglot, really. He spoke French, but he was Italian and monoglot. He spoke one language. And above all, he had an illusion that if he managed to get as many different people as possible, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, communists, Hindus, Buddhists, into his Vatican Council, there would be a new Pentecost. The Holy Ghost would actually enlighten everybody with a new flaming deluge of tongues, and the world would be one again in love and faith in Christ.
So he was chasing an illusion.
Absolutely, chasing an illusion. Then he was also, see, he also had another view completely of Europe and Marxism. He was came from the poor, and therefore he did think the imbalance between poor and rich should be corrected. That, of course, was taken by his Marxist collaborators as a way of pushing him towards a compromise with Nikita Khrushchev. No, John was a liberal, and unfortunately his piety was not sufficient to give him perception. He did go to Fatima, by the way, as a cardinal. And he did want to be known as the Pope of Fatima. He did institute a feast day of Our Lady of Fatima. But when it came to the Fatima revelations and the mandate of Our Lady, because it directly, head-to-head on, went against his Ostpolitik, his policy of reconciliation with Soviet Union, he would have none of it. And therefore he said, this is not for our time. And the question what one would love to have asked him is, why didn't Our Lady tell us that? If she says, in 1960 the Pope must open this and publicize it to all the nations of the world. Nobody wouldn't dare ask him that.
Before John the 23rd died, did he realize that something was starting to go wrong?
Yes, he did, insofar as his carcinoma allowed him. Because from March on, John was in a very bad condition, March 1963. He died on June 3, and in a horrible agony of hours of horrible pain. But he used to say at the end, it's no longer non è il mio concilio, this is no longer my council. After the first session, he knew that the anti-force had taken over. Because, as you know, in his preparation for the council, he had a preparatory commission. And they prepared what they called schemata, that is, documents, which would be discussed by the bishops in council. They'd modify it, change it, adapt it to their individual needs and the needs of the Church Universal, and then stamp it with their signature.
Archbishop Lefebvre was on his council, wasn't he?
He was. Archbishop Lefebvre was. What happened was, in the first session, they simply said, we don't want these documents. We've got to have new documents. And the new documents were exactly tailored to that blessed ambivalence they wanted. And from then on, he knew the council was going down. Physically then, you see, the carcinoma was eating away at his vitals, and he was already over 80. And he simply physically hadn't the strength. And apparently, he hadn't got the grace, or Christ didn't want him to do anything, because over all this burnout, over all this mess, this disintegration of the Catholic Church in its institutional organization, and the infidelity of priests and nuns and cardinals and bishops, and the connivance, say, amongst European cardinals against John Paul II, and amongst American cardinals against John Paul II at the present moment. Overall, you must say to yourself, this has been permitted by Christ. He is, after all powerful. He could change all hearts. He hasn't. He has allowed it go like that. So this is permitted by Christ, not willed. And it's something you must reflect on, we must all reflect on, that he has allowed it. He has allowed this victory of Satan. Because it is a victory, a marvelous victory. It's a terrible victory for us, but for him it's a superb victory. He has successfully infiltrated the church in its highest levels, right up to the throne of Peter. So we must say that about John 23rd, he wasn't given the grace to see where the errors he made. And Paul VI wasn't given the errors to correct his weakness. He was a great pope in other ways, but he could not correct them. Why? He didn't get the grace. That's the most charitable thing we can say. Let God judge him. As you know, poor Paul VI went around Castel Gandolfo in his last days, shuffling, because he had terribly swollen legs with phlebitis, besides his lungs were giving out. And all they could hear him say when he didn't think anybody was with him were, "Brief de conversation," little stretches from the credo. Credo in unum Deum, credo in Ecclesiam Catholica, credo in unum Deum, credo in Christum Dominum, as if to assure himself on the verge of eternity that it all held still intact.
He seemed to be somewhat helpless as a pope.
Totally helpless. He was already coddled and swaddled in the folds of the superforce installed in the Vatican. And he could do nothing about it, just as John Paul II can't. The only thing is that John Paul II, coming from a distant land, being a fighter, having his own geopolitical point of view, has decided on an end game. He's going to double right around it, he says, and thinks, and plans. He's not... Paul VI is not an Italian, and he's not John 23rd. He has no illusions. This man has no illusions at all.
What is his game plan? Or what was his game plan when he came to office in 1978?
Geopolitical. That is, he accepted the fact there was no possibility of renewal. No way he could scour out the church. No way he could reform the cardinals. No way he could clean out the Vatican bureaucracy. No way he could change the mass of the clergy in Latin America. No way he could save the Jesuits. He tried to suppress them. That was his intent originally, in removing the general of the Jesuits. And finally, he stopped that. There was no point in any further attempt. But he did believe and does believe and holds firmly that he is the watchman on the wall waiting for Our Lady to come in the skies. It sounds fantastic. That is his belief. That will happen in his lifetime and soon. And soon, not late. And we're now in the banner years of that. You know, a lot of people didn't understand or didn't even take time to understand him in 19, 1987. He established the Marian Year. No, 1988, established the Marian Year. And he began in the middle of June and ended in August. And nobody understood why should have a Marian Year, which was longer, 13 months, and which apparently went nowhere. He was preparing for Gorbachev and the present shake-up of the entire structure of the world, the Society of Nations. But that's another question.
And this is a topic which we will take up in our final tape on Inside the Vatican.